I am Plant Online. This is thecommentary.ca. Brian Brett joins me now. His new book is called Trauma Farm, A Rebel History of Rural Life. It's described as a thoroughly entertaining meditation on small mixed farming, and Mr. Brett is described as one of Canada's most erudite, passionate, and hilarious writers of our time. The book has gotten good notices and has even received a Writers' Trust Nonfiction Prize nomination. Brian gives us a view onto living on a farm, exploring it, sometimes nude, and thinking about our relationship with the land amidst globalization and mass farming. Brian Brett is the acclaimed author of Uproar Is Your Only Music. He will be appearing with one of my favorite people, a former guest here, Mark Forsyth, host of BC Almanac and CBC Radio, at the Vancouver International Writers and Readers Festival, October 25th. Trauma Farm is published by Greystone. Please welcome to the Plant Online program on Salt Spring Island this day, Brian Brett. Good morning, Mr. Brett.
Good morning, Joel.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
This may be an odd question for the author of the book, but everyone who's read the book and that I've heard and talked to have said that they really like the book, that that it's a favorite of theirs, that it's moving, it's thoughtful, it's insightful. Why do you think that is, and what do you think it says about us?
I think what it says about us is what I am seeing in the book, is our essential humanness, and that's the quality that I most wanted to capture in this book. I didn't want to do a kind of standard natural history about the area between the wilderness, the margin between the wilderness and the big city, right? In order to try and tell the story of this, I developed a kind of different way of doing it rather than doing a standard kind of linear natural history. I turned it into a personal memoir, and I used the sort of conceit, I guess, as it were, of a single day that goes back to all through the 18 years that we've been on the farm, but also goes back in time right to Babylon and forward to globalization. So what I've done is created this structure in which I wanted to capture the wholeness of it, because the book itself is an argument for a wholeness in living.
Now, you were born in Vancouver, right?
Yep.
Where'd you grow up here?
Pretty well all through the Fraser Valley. My father worked in the valley, and he was actually a peddler, and we used to go out to all the farms and buy potatoes and apples and stuff. The family kept moving further out. They were from originally, right, from, you know, the east end of Vancouver, and then sort of moved to Burnaby and then to Surrey and Delta, and then gradually ended up in Comox.
And so you moved to Salt Spring 18 years ago. Mm-hmm. What compelled you to do that?
Well, I sort of also, besides spending a lot of time in the valley, in the farm region there, my father would sometimes spend the summers fishing, and he actually even had a commercial fish boat at one point. So I kind of grew up with all my summers on the islands, and I knew most of the islands pretty well and have lived on them at various points. I lived for 2 years on Texada Island, for instance, and have spent lots of time up in Hornby and Galliano and just about the whole crew, except maybe Laskiti.
Now, this book, did it take you a long time to write? What compelled you to write the book?
Oh, it took me forever to write. I guess I was sort of driven to it by several friends who kept saying, I kind of knew I would write about the farm, but I just couldn't find the way of telling it. And so it was when I got, there was a number of people, Margaret Atwood, Wayne Grady, and finally the publisher, Rob Sanders. I got cornered, and he said, "You got to do this book. You know all these things about the small mixed farm and stuff, that you could create a really kind of interesting book around it." And it just sort of popped into my head as I was talking to the publisher, and said, "Well, if I did it, the only way I'd want to do it is like that, because I don't want to just tell about, you know, I just don't want to write a memoir. I want to write a natural history. But I think that the memoir idea could be used as a form for doing the natural history." And then what happened, and it took me quite a while, right? I'd been researching, and I'd actually been collecting stuff for years, but I didn't have any sort of real form to it. And just almost at the same time, it struck me as what I should do is, instead of following a linear kind of book, I mean, I do use the day as a sort of a rough outline for following it as the events of one single day that goes back and forth in time. But I also thought what I really would like to do is use the native, the traditional native tale-telling method. And it seemed to me that that was a much more inclusive thing. And it's just a wonderful way of telling stories because they don't need time, right? They can go back and forth in time. And because native cultures didn't have books, they used their stories as vehicles for, they were cultural, cultural kind of conditioning or social awareness, so that it tells you how to have good manners in a native story. It tells you how to make tools. It tells you how to survive in certain kinds of conditions, how to hunt, so that they actually have all kinds of mechanical values, as well as telling you history and how relationships work and families and all kinds of things. So everything is all combined in these one vehicle. A native tale is like their encyclopedia. So what I decided to do was to create this form. So that way, because I think the main argument in the book is against the reductionist sort of logic that has driven us to the factory farm and to the horror of all these diseases that are being created by the factory farms, like H1N1, avian flu, and BSE, and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time that all of that is happening with the factory farms, they're regulating everything for better safety, and the regulations are designed to destroy the small farms. That's why they've destroyed the Salt Spring Lamb, right? And we call it the Salt Spring Lamb Massacre. Salt Spring is one of the most famous lambs in the world, and they're almost, 90% eliminated in the last 4 years just due to regulations, right? They've driven everybody out of sheep, right?
Right.
So it's quite a tragedy. So what I wanted to do was create a book whose very style was its argument.
Say I came over for lunch today, and you were kind enough to prepare lunch. Would what we ate be all from the farm?
Usually, most of it, depending on the time of year. We do keep a lot of stuff. We preserve a lot, and we have this great temperate climate where we cloche and so on. But sure, I drink coffee, and I drink. I'm not a 100-mile dieter. Right, I have my weaknesses. I can't make scotch. We do, but most of the stuff, especially in the summer months. In fact, we sell a lot of things to the local markets and the local organic food place, garlic and so on. So we have a good small mixed palate, and I know every animal in my freezer.
Now, the how much planning goes into what you'll raise, what you'll grow on the farm? Did you do a lot of pre-thinking, perhaps, or no?
No. Unfortunately not, or maybe fortunately not.
Yeah.
It just sort of develops. It also develops what sells and what we like, right? So, for instance, we really are very keen horticulturalists, and Sharon especially really does a great deal, 90% of the gardening work these days, because I've been so busy with the book. But we also do things like willows. We sell pussy willows and decorative willows in the winter months for the Ikebana market, for instance. We have all kinds of exotic kinds of willows that flower arrangers go crazy for and so on.
How many people live on the farm? It's you, your wife, Sharon?
Yep.
And who else?
Nobody at the moment. We used to have our youngest boy, but he's a lot older since we moved here, so he's got his own place and his own children, of course. And when he came over, or when we first came over, we brought him, of course, and we brought a number of his friends came with us and sort of lived with us for several years off and on, and helped us with the original framing up of the farm, as it were. I mean, we had to fence the entire place. There was no fencing or anything like that, right? So we've done sort of 10 acres of split rail fencing, cross fencing, and the garden, and a very large garden and an orchard and various things like that.
How many? What sort of animals have you got, and how many?
What have we got now? We've got right now about a dozen sheep, about 25 heritage chickens, very gorgeous birds that have a tendency, because they're real chickens, they have a tendency to wander everywhere.
Yeah.
They're constantly having to herd them back into the chicken yard. And, of course, the new CFI regulations that they're talking about enforcing in Vancouver with the new bird thing, those are, you know, according to those, a bird is not supposed to come in contact with soil.
Right.
Right. So these are, they want to restrict all barnyard fowl to basically closed facilities with filtered air and artificial light. But so far, it's not the law. It is pretty well all regulation with any kind of factory farm with more than 200 birds. But since we raise birds normally in small quantities, which is the healthier way of doing it, and not as much chance of disease and problems when you have smaller quantities of birds, we're still allowed to do that. But I would imagine they're going to eliminate chickens pretty quick.
What do you make of this thing in Vancouver of having chickens in our backyards? Do you think that's a good idea?
Oh, I think it's a wonderful idea. It's a really great, and it used to be very common. Right, people grew a lot of their own food in their yards. When I was a kid in Vancouver, I mean, that's one of the things that inspired me was my Italian grandfather, whose backyard was a wonder to behold. And I used to have chickens often at times, and he used to actually go down the street with a bucket and a shovel, chasing or following the milk wagons and the rag wagons and stuff like that to collect manure for the garden. They're very good, and you know, if you keep a good tight coop and clean, and so you don't get rat problems. It's a wonderful way of dealing with your compost, getting yourself really good healthy food, and really keeping the bugs. The chicken keeps the bugs down a hell of a lot better than any kind of spray that you're going to use.
A few years ago, even before all this happened, my dad used to keep quail in the garage.
Right.
And my mom used to take the manure and put it in the garden. Yeah, and it was quite. It worked for them. The butchering of animals, do you do that on your farm?
I'm not allowed to anymore.
No.
I can do it for myself. So if I'm eating something myself, if I'm going to have a mutton or something, I will do that for myself. But it's against the law now they've taken away the great traditional farm gate production that we were allowed to have. It just disappeared, last October, the law eliminated that. Before then, you were allowed to be able to slaughter. You couldn't sell stuff for restaurants or commercially through the system, but you could sell farm gate, is what they called, and that was the traditional way. And so all the people on Salt Spring would buy lambs off us, and often some of the farmers we'd team up and we'd slaughter together and do it all and had coolers and so on. But that's all been banned. Right, in order to make everybody, all of lambs have to go to one or two facilities on Vancouver Island, which is, of course, creating disease vectors and horror stories like that, potentials. Anyways, very scary stuff, right? So they've actually, as far as I'm concerned, they've endangered our health more. It took us many, many years to be able to learn to respect traditional culture of Native people, and yet, while we are just beginning to do that, we are at the same time destroying our own traditional culture. So this kind of knowledge is just being eliminated, just gone.
You mentioned this danger to our health. Oh, so what should we do, those of us that live in cities?
Fight for local produce and fight against the regulation that is coming between the community and the farmers.
Yeah.
What they really want to do is have all farming in closed containment facilities. I would think they'd even prefer all vegetables. I would imagine the next wave of regulation will be to restrict, like for instance, we use pond water for our irrigation. Mm-hmm. They're going to want to go to all sealed systems and so on, right? The main enemy right now of the small farm is the Canadian government.
How often do you wander the farm naked?
Not very often.
No.
Actually, not very often at all, but every once in a while I would do that. Or you hear a ruckus, and you run out there, you just slip on your boots, and you know, if it's in the middle of the night, you just tear off out there to see what's going on in case something is out there killing all the chickens and so on. So, unfortunately, I'm going to get a real reputation over mentioning two scenes in there where I do that. But I actually, now that I think about it, there are quite a few times at night where I'll just jump into my gumboots and, you know, about every couple of months and we'll have a coon attack or something and the dogs will be out there fighting with a raccoon or something like that. So you do have to tear out there and make sure everything's all safe and tight and so on.
What's it like to write on the farm? I mean, is it any different than writing, say, in a city?
Writing?
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't imagine it's a... it actually works very well for me because of the nature of my health and that I really need a lot of exercise. So what I do is I have a tendency to get up about 6 in the morning, and then I work and where my room has a greenhouse adjoining it, and so it gets pretty hot in there by the afternoon. So then I go outside and do the physical work. So it's pretty good. I've got my parrot since he's in here. He's actually behaving himself right at the moment. He can get pretty raucous when I get on the phone sometimes. He keeps me amused, and he keeps an eye on the farm. He overlooks all from where he sits. I can't sort of see it from my office, but the parrot can. So he lets me know when anything's going on. He's a better alarm system than our dogs. Our geese used to be pretty good, and the peacocks are quite amazing. Right? They create a ruckus if there's anything going on around out there. If there's eagle attack flying about or something like that.
Now, how do you write? Do you write on a computer?
Yep.
Yeah, and in terms of reading, do you do a lot of reading for your writing?
There's a ton of reading that went in the list book. I have a full filing cabinet of downloads of various things that I've used that are found on the internet, as well as a lot of books, right? I've got 4 feet of books that I just own on the issues that are in the farm community and that I deal with in the book. As you'll notice from the book, it's humongously diversified. And that was part of the concept, to show all of the diversity of things. And not only is there poetry, and not only is there death, but there's also absurdity and comic moments. And I really wanted to put all of those in the book. And that's why people can say, I mean, because some of the book is really quite funny.
It is.
I hope so, anyways.
Yeah.
But and that's part of being in when you're living close to the ground, absurd things naturally happen.
What's the relationship that man has with a pig?
Well, they various people have different relationships. The thing is, we assume because we have one cultural relationship that's the only relationship. But one of the things I talk about in the book is that the Engwa province in New Guinea, the men there have they say that their relationship with their pigs is better than with their wives. There's various cultures that have different attitudes towards them. A lot of them actually live with them right in the communities, running in the streets and so on until recently. Now we're at the stage where we have factories that slaughter 6,000 pigs in a single day. Imagine the manure that's just being pumped out of places like that. They've turned something as beautiful as manure into a toxic substance, right? And these plants, some of these plants are so... They say that they're unbearable for the sound of the screaming of the pigs, right? Then these are not, this is where they grow them. They now grow young pigs right to adult slaughtering stage in these gigantic factories where you have biosecurity going in and everybody has to hose down and wear special uniforms and masks and gloves and so on just to be able to work with these poor things that are all locked up and living these tortured lives on this really very strange diet that we give them, which forces them to grow at unnatural rates. It's just amazing what we do to our food, and the fact that we eat that stuff is and people go out in the stores and buy that is, I mean, they have no idea, and that's one of the reasons why the factories don't let people in there,
because
they don't want people to see what they're doing to the food that you're eating, right?
Your brother Howard, did he live with you?
No, Howard was not my brother. Howard was the brother of Mike Byron,
okay.
One of our mentors. When we came to this island, when we first moved here, I met the Byrons fairly early on, and his brother was the sort of town, or the island, I guess, dog catcher and various other things, a farmer and orchardist, and I got to be pretty friendly with Howard before he passed away. He was a really wonderful man, and I talk about him several times in there. One of the things about him was he was one of the greatest connoisseurs of apples that I've met. Making apple juice with him was like working with a gourmand or with a vintner, right? He was like a vintner of apple juice.
Yeah.
Right. He could just tell from the taste what kind of variety of apples to put in to alter the taste slightly. the apple juice that that I crushed. He made me. I did all the slave labor, of course, right? And he would sort of sit there and say, you know, more golden grimes or whatever it was that we needed for the apple juice in the fall when we'd make these big batches, which he would sell to out of his farm stand, and that's also illegal now, right? Because it all has to be
pasteurized,
right? And in the factories, yeah, it does have to be pasteurized, but locally, I mean, we don't do that stuff. You know, and if you did, you would have it come back at you pretty quick if you were selling that, because you know when you're dealing with things in your community, people get to know what's happening, and if you do anything wrong, they know exactly where it came from, right? Whereas now, of course, if you get a piece of meat poison, it can be the next day it's in Guam or Nevada or whatever, right? And that's how they can taint 6 million tons of hamburger in a few hours in some of those plants and stuff.
Now, there's a scene in the book that I read that just was quite touching, is when they buried Howard.
Mm-hmm.
What did his dog do?
Dog tried to jump into the grave with him, actually. It was very, boy, there wasn't a dry eye in the place. The dog was the most devoted, wonderful border collie. Big Mackie, he used to call him, and he rounded up a goose for us once. And he was just amazing. He'd just walk everything up right up to you. And he was so calm and patient about doing it, he wouldn't even fluster them. The sheep or whatever you wanted would just sort of gradually find itself standing beside you, right? Border collies are quite amazing. Ours are like that. We'll send a pile of people out that's visiting for a walk in the field, and they'll all leave sort of all scattered around and so on. And then by the time, I always say to the people that stay in the house, I say, watch this, watch them come back. And, well, of course, when they come back, they're out in a big wide field, and yet they're tripping over each other's feet because they don't realize that the border collie has gradually moved them into a herd.
Huh.
Right? They're quite amazing that way.
Is this where you'll die?
I don't know where I will die, but actually, where I will die is, I know that my ashes will be scattered off of Rebecca's Spit on Quadra Island.
Brian, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you and read this book. Congratulations on it, and continued good luck with the book.
Oh, thank you very much.
Brian Brett, on the line from Salt Spring Island. The book is called Trauma Farm, A Rebel History of Rural Life. It's published by Greystone. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plata.